but Durham's scan file was gone, deleted as meticulously, as irreversibly as her own. The audit record showed no sign that the data had been preserved elsewhere. Like her own file, it had even been flagged explicitly for exclusion from the JSN's automatic hourly backups. The only place the data had been reproduced had been inside the Garden of Eden configuration itself, and every trace of that structure had been obliterated. She sat at the terminal, replaying the file which showed Durham's copy conducting his experiments, testing the laws of his universe, rushing joyfully towards, what, the unheralded, inexplicable annihilation of everything he was in the process of establishing as the basis for his own existence? And now his corpse lay in the bathroom, dead by his own hands, on his own terms, victim of his own seamless logic. Maria buried her face in her hands. She wanted to believe that the two deaths were not the same. She wanted to believe that Durham had been right all along. What had the JSN computers in Tokyo and Seoul meant to the copy? No experiment performed within the TVC universe could ever have proved or disproved the existence of those machines. They were as irrelevant, to him, as Francesca's ludicrous god who makes no difference. So how could they have destroyed him? How could he be dead? There were quick, heavy footsteps outside, then a pounding on the door. Maria went to open it. She wanted to believe, but she couldn't. Chapter 22. Remit Not Paucity, June 2051. Thomas prepared himself to witness a death. The flesh-and-blood Ryman was the man who'd killed Anna, not the copy who'd inherited the killer's memories. And the flesh-and-blood Ryman should have had the opportunity to reflect on that before dying. He should have had a chance to accept his guilt, to accept his mortality, and to absolve his successor. That hadn't been allowed to happen. But it wasn't too late, even now. A software clone could still do it for him, believing itself to be flesh and blood, revealing what the mortal human self would have done if only it had known that it was dying. Thomas had found a suitable picture in a photo album, old chemical hard copy images which he'd had digitized and restored soon after the onset of his final illness, Christmas 1985. His mother, his father, his sister Karen, and himself, gathered outside the family home, dazzled by the winter sunshine. Karen, gentle and shy, had died of lymphoma before the turn of the century. His parents had both survived into their 90s, showing every sign of achieving immortality by sheer force of will. But they'd died before scanning technology was perfected, having scorned Thomas's suggestion of cryonic preservation.
"I have no intention," his father had explained curtly, "of doing to myself what nouveau riche Americans have done to their pets."
The young man in the photograph didn't look much like the image Thomas would have conjured up by closing his eyes and struggling to remember. But the expression on his face, captured in transition from haunted to smug, rang true. Half afraid that the camera would reveal his secret, half daring it to try. Thomas had kept copies of his deathbed scan file offline, in vaults in Geneva and New York, with no explicit purpose in mind, other than the vaguest notion that if something went irreparably wrong with his model, and the source of the problem, a slow virus, a subtle programming error, rendered all of his snapshots suspect, starting life again with no memory since 2045 would be better than nothing. Having assembled the necessary elements, he'd scripted the whole scenario in advance and let it run, without observing the results. Then he'd frozen the clone and sent it to Durham at the last possible moment, without giving himself a chance to back out, or worse, to decide that he'd botched the first attempt and to try again. Now he was ready to discover what he'd done, to view the fait accompli. Seated in the library, with the drinks cabinet locked, he gestured to the terminal to begin. The old man in the bed looked much worse than Thomas had expected. Sunken-eyed, jaundiced, and nearly bald. So much for the honesty of his own appearance, the minimal changes he'd made to render himself presentable. His chest was furrowed with scars, crisscrossed by a grid of electrodes. His skull was capped with a similar mesh. A pump suspended beside the bed fed a needle in his right arm. The clone was sedated by a crudely modeled synthetic opiate flowing into his crudely modeled bloodstream, just as Thomas's original had been sedated by the real thing, from the time of the scan until his death 3 days later. In this replay, though, the narcotic was scheduled to undergo a sudden drop in concentration, for no physically plausible reason, but none was required. A graph in a corner of the screen plotted the decline. Thomas watched, sick with anxiety, feverish with hope. This, at last, was the ritual which he'd always believed might have cured him. The old man attained consciousness without opening his eyes. The EEG waveforms meant nothing to Thomas, but the software monitoring the simulation had flagged the event with a subtitle. Further text followed. The anesthetic still hasn't taken. Can't they get anything right? Garbled verbalization. The scan can't be over. I can't be the copy yet. The copy will wake with a clear head, seated in the library, pre-modified to feel no disorientation. So why am I awake? The old man opened his eyes. Thomas shouted, "Freeze!" He was sweating and nauseous, but he made no move to banish the unnecessary symptoms. He wanted catharsis, didn't he? Wasn't that the whole point? The subtitles gave only a crude hint of what the clone was experiencing. Much greater clarity was available. The recording included traces from key neural pathways. If he wanted to, he could read the clone's mind. He said, "Let me know what he's thinking, what he's going through." Nothing happened. He clenched his fists and whispered, "Restart." The library vanished. He was flat on his back in the hospital bed, staring up at the ceiling, dazed. He looked down and saw the cluster of monitors beside him, the wires on his chest. The motion of his eyes and head was wrong, intelligible, but distressingly out of sync with his intentions. He felt fearful and disoriented, but he wasn't sure how much of that was his own reaction and how much belonged to the clone. Thomas shook his own head in panic, and the library and his body returned. He stopped the playback and reconsidered. He could break free any time he wanted to. He was only an observer. There was nothing to fear. Fighting down a sense of suffocation, he closed his eyes and surrendered to the recording. He looked around the room groggily. He wasn't the copy, that much was certain. And this wasn't any part of the Landau Clinic. As a VIP shareholder and future client, he'd toured the building too many times to be wrong about that. If the scan had been postponed for some reason, he ought to be back home, or on his way. Unless something had gone wrong requiring medical attention, which the Landau was unable to provide. The room was deserted, and the door was closed. He called out hoarsely, "Nurse!" He was too weak to shout. The room controller replied, "No staff are available to attend to you at present. Can I be of assistance?"
"Can you tell me where I am?"
"You're in room 307 of Valhalla."
"Valhalla?"
He knew he'd done business with the place, but he couldn't remember why. The room controller said helpfully,
"Valhalla is the Health Dynamics Corporation of America's Frankfurt Hospice."
His balls loosened with fright. They were already empty. Thomas squirmed in sympathy, but kept himself from breaking free. Valhalla was the meat rack he'd hired to take care of his comatose body until it expired, after the scan, with the legal minimum of medical attention, with no heroic measures to prolong life. He had been scanned, but they'd fucked up. They'd let him wake. It was a shock, but he came to terms with it rapidly. There was no reason to panic. He'd be out of here and scanned again in 6 hours flat, and whoever was responsible would be out on the streets even faster. He tried to raise himself into a sitting position, but he was too dizzy from the lingering effects of the drug infusion to coordinate the action. He slumped back onto the pillows, caught his breath, and forced himself to speak calmly.
"I want to talk to the director."
"I'm sorry, the director is not available."
"Then the most senior member of staff you can find."
"No staff are available to attend to you at present."
Sweat trickled into his eyes. There was no point screaming about lawsuits to this machine. In fact, it might be prudent not to scream about lawsuits to anyone. A place like this would be perfectly capable of responding by simply drugging him back into a coma. What he needed to do was let someone outside know about the situation. He said,
"I'd like to make a phone call. Can you connect me to the net?"
"I have no authority to do that."
"I can give you an account number linked to my voice print and authorize you to charge me for the service."
"I have no authority to accept your account number."
"Then make a call, reversing all charges to Rudolf Dieterl of Dieterl Hollingworth and Partners."
"I have no authority to make such a call."
He laughed, disbelieving.
"Are you physically capable of connecting me to the net at all?"
"I have no authority to disclose my technical specifications."
Any insult would have been a waste of breath. He lifted his head and surveyed the room. There was no furniture, no drawers, no table, no visitor's chair. Just the monitors to one side of his bed, mounted on stainless steel trolleys. And no terminal, no communications equipment of any kind, not even a wall-mounted audio handset. He probed the needle in his forearm, just below the inside of the elbow. A tight, seamless rubber sleeve, several centimeters wide, covered the entry point. It seemed to take forever to get his fingernails under the edge, and once he'd succeeded, it was no help. The sleeve was too tight to be dragged down his arm, and too elastic to be rolled up like a shirt sleeve. How did anyone ever take the thing off? He tugged at the drip tube itself. Held in place by the sleeve, it showed no sign of yielding. The other end vanished inside the drug pump. Thomas began to wonder if the immovable needle on top of the Kafkaesque room controller would make the clone suspicious. But it seemed that the possibility of some future self waking the scan file a second time was too convoluted an explanation to occur to him in the middle of a crisis like this. He'd have to take the pump with him. That was a nuisance, but if he was going to march through the building wrapped in a sheet, looking for a terminal, it could hardly make him more conspicuous than he would have been anyway. He started to peel the electrodes from his chest when a pulse of numbing warmth swept through his right arm. The pump beeped twice. He turned to see a green LED glowing brightly in the middle of the box, a light he hadn't noticed before. The wave of paralysis spread out from his shoulder before he could react. Crimp the tube? He tried to roll himself out of the bed, but if his body responded at all, he couldn't feel it. His eyes fluttered closed. He struggled to remain conscious and succeeded. The script guaranteed the clone several minutes of lucidity, which had nothing to do with the opiate's true pharmacological effects. There'd be a computer log of his EEG. Someone would be alerted soon to the fact that he'd been awake, and they'd understand that the only humane thing to do would be to revive him. But someone should have been alerted the moment he woke. It was far more likely that he'd be left to die. Thomas felt ill. This was sadistic, insane. It was too late for squeamishness, though. Everything he was witnessing had already happened. His body was numb, but his mind was crystalline. Without the blur of visceral distractions, his fear seemed pure, sharper than anything he'd ever experienced. He tried to dredge up the familiar, comforting truths. The copy would survive. It would live his life for him. This body was always destined to perish. He'd accepted that long ago. Death was the irreversible dissolution of the personality. This wasn't death. It was a shedding of skin. There was nothing to fear. Unless he was wrong about death. Wrong about everything. He lay paralyzed in darkness, wishing for sleep, terrified of sleep, wishing for anything that might distract him, afraid of wasting his last precious minutes, afraid of not being prepared. Prepared? What could that mean? Extinction required no preparation. He wasn't making any deathbed pleas to a god he'd stopped believing in at the age of 12. He wasn't about to cast aside 70 years of freedom and sanity to return to his infantile faith. Approach the kingdom of heaven as a child or you won't get in? That very line was one which had helped him see through the crude mechanics of entrapment. The translation was all too obvious, even to a child. This bullshit would insult any adult's intelligence, but swallow it anyway, or you'll burn forever. He was still afraid, though. The hooks had gone in deep. The irony was, he had finally come to his senses and abandoned the whole insane idea of having himself woken intentionally. To confront his mortality, to purge his copy of guilt, what a pathetic fucking joke that would have been. And now the supposed beneficiary of that fatuous gesture would never even know that it had happened anyway, by accident. The blackness in his skull seemed to open out, an invisible view expanding into an invisible vista. Any sense of being in the hospice bed, merely numb and sightless, was gone now. He was lost on a plane of darkness. What could he have told the copy anyway? The miserable truth? I'm dying in fear? I killed Anna for no reason but selfishness and cowardice? And now, in spite of everything, I'm still afraid that there might be an afterlife? A god? Judgment? I've regressed far enough to start wondering if every childish superstition I ever held might yet turn out to be true, but not far enough to embrace the possibility of repentance? Or some anodyne lie? I'm dying in peace, I've found forgiveness, I've laid all my ghosts to rest. And you're free now to live your own life. The sins of the Father will not be visited upon the Son. Would that have worked? Would that have helped? Some formula as inane as the voodoo of confession? As glib as the dying words of some tortured soul finding Hollywood redemption? He felt himself moving across the darkness. No tunnels of light. No light at all. Sedative dreams. Not near-death hallucinations. Death was hours or days away. By then, he'd surely be comatose again. One small mercy. He waited. No revelations. No insights. No lightning bolts of blinding faith. Just blackness and uncertainty and fear. Thomas sat motionless in front of the terminal, long after the recording had finished. The clone had been right. The ritual had been pointless, misguided. He was and always would be the murderer. Nothing could make him see himself as the innocent software child of the dead Thomas Ryman, unfairly burdened with the killer's guilt. Not unless he redefined himself completely, edited his memories, rewrote his personality, sculpted his mind into someone new. In other words, died. That was the choice. He had to live with what he was in its entirety, or create another person who'd inherit only part of what he'd been. He laughed angrily and shook his head.
I'm not passing through the eye of any needle. I killed Anna. I killed Anna. That's who I am.
He reached for the scar which defined him, and stroked it as if it were a talisman. He sat for a while longer, reliving the night in Hamburg one more time, weeping with shame at what he'd done. Then he unlocked the drinks cabinet and proceeded to make himself confident and optimistic. The ritual had been pointless, but if nothing else, it had rid him of the delusion that it might have been otherwise. Some time later, he thought about the clone, drifting into narcosis, suffering a crudely modeled extrapolation of the disease which had killed the original, and then, at the moment of simulated death, taking on a new body, young and healthy, with a face plucked from a photograph from Christmas 1985. Resurrection, for an instant, no more than a formality. The script had frozen the young murderer without even waking him. And then? Thomas was too far gone to agonize about it. He'd done what he'd done for the sake of the ritual. He'd delivered the clone into Durham's hands to grant it, like the flesh and blood it believed itself to be, the remote chance of another life in a world beyond death, unknowable. And if the whole thing had been a mistake, there was no way now to undo it. Part 2. Permutation City. Chapter 23. Marie awoke from dreamless sleep, clear-headed, tranquil. She opened her eyes and looked around. The bed, the room, were unfamiliar. Both were large and luxurious. Everything appeared unnaturally pristine, unsullied by human habitation, like an expensive hotel room. She was puzzled but unperturbed. An explanation seemed to be on the verge of surfacing. She was wearing a nightdress she'd never seen before in her life. She suddenly remembered the Landau Clinic, chatting with the technicians, borrowing the marker pen, the tour of the recovery rooms, the anesthetist asking her to count. She pulled her hands out from beneath the sheet. Her left palm was blank. The comforting message she'd written there was gone. She felt the blood drain from her face. Before she had a chance to think, Durham stepped into the room. For a moment she was too shocked to make a sound. Then she screamed at him.
What have you done to me? I'm the copy, aren't I? You're running the copy.
Trapped in the launch software with 2 minutes to live? Durham said quietly. Yes, you're the copy.
How? How did you do it? How could I let it happen?
She stared at him, desperate for a reply, enraged more than anything else by the thought that they might both vanish before she'd heard the explanation, before she understood how he'd broken through all of her elaborate safeguards. But Durham just stood by the doorway, looking bemused and embarrassed, as if he'd anticipated a reaction like this, but couldn't quite credit it now that it was happening. Finally she said,
This isn't the launch, is it? This is later. You're another version. You stole me. You're running me later.
I didn't steal you. He hesitated, then added cautiously, I think you know exactly where you are, and I agonized about waking you, but I had to do it. There's too much going on here that you'll want to see, want to be a part of. I couldn't let you sleep through it all. That would have been unforgivable. Maria disregarded everything he'd said.
You kept my scan file after the launch. You duplicated it, somehow.
No. The only place your scan file data ever went was the Garden of Eden configuration, as agreed. And now you're in Permutation City, in the TVC universe now commonly known as Elysium, running on nothing but its own laws. Maria sat up in bed slowly, bringing her knees up to her chest, trying to accept the situation without panicking, without falling apart. Durham was insane, unpredictable, dangerous. When was she going to get that into her skull? In the flesh, she could probably have broken his fucking neck if she had to defend herself. But if he controlled this environment, she was powerless. He could rape her, torture her, do anything at all. The very idea of him attacking her still seemed ludicrous, but she couldn't rely on the way he'd treated her in the past to count for anything. He was a liar and a kidnapper. She didn't know him at all. Right now, though, he was being as civilized as ever. He seemed intent on keeping up the charade. She was afraid to test this veneer of hospitality, but she forced herself to say evenly,
"I want to use a terminal."
Durham gestured at the space above the bed, and a terminal appeared. Maria's heart sank. She realized that she'd been hanging on to the slender hope that she might have been human, and that was still possible. Durham himself had once been memory-wiped and fooled into thinking he was a copy when he was merely a visitor. Or at least he'd claim that it had happened in another world. She tried half a dozen numbers, starting with Francesca's, ending with Aiden's. The terminal declared them all invalid. She couldn't bring herself to try her own. Durham watched in silence. He seemed to be caught between genuine sympathy and a kind of clinical fascination, as if an attempt to make a few phone calls cast doubt on her sanity, as if she was engaged in some bizarre psychotic behavior worthy of the closest scrutiny. Peering behind a mirror in search of the object seen in the reflection, talking back to a television program, or making calls on a toy phone. Maria pushed the floating machine away angrily. It moved easily, but came to a halt as soon as she took her hands off it. Patchwork VR and its physics of convenience seemed like the final insult. She said,
"Do you think I'm stupid? What does a dummy terminal prove?"
"Nothing. So why don't you apply your own criteria?" he said. "Central computer." And the terminal flashed up an icon-studded menu, headed Permutation City Computing Facility. Not many people use this interface these days. It's the original version, designed before the launch, but it still plugs you into as much computing power as the latest co-personality links. He showed Maria a text file. She recognized it immediately. It was a program she'd written herself to solve a large, intentionally difficult set of diophantine equations. The output of this program was the key they'd agreed upon to unlock Durham's access to the other copies after the launch. He ran it. It spat out its results immediately. A screen full of numbers, the smallest of which was 20 digits long. On any real-world computer, it should have taken years. Maria was unimpressed.
"You could have frozen us while the program was running, making it seem like no time had passed, or you could have generated the answers in advance."
She gestured at the terminal.
"I expect you're faking all of this. You're not talking to a genuine operating system. You're not really running the program at all."
"Feel free to alter some parameters in the equations and try again." She did. The modified program ran just as quickly, churning out a new set of answers. She laughed sourly.
"So what am I supposed to do now? Verify all this in my head? You could put any bullshit you liked on the screen. I wouldn't know the difference. And if I wrote another program to check the results, you could fake its operations too. You control this whole environment, don't you? So I can't trust anything. Whatever I do to try to test your claims, you can intervene and make it go your way. Is that why you wanted my scan file all along? So you could lock me in here and bombard me with lies? Finally prove all your mad ideas to someone?"
"You're being paranoid now."
"Am I? You're the expert."
She looked around the luxurious prison cell. Red velvet curtains stirred in a faint breeze. She slipped out of bed and crossed the room, ignoring Durham. The more she argued with him, the harder it was to be physically afraid of him. He'd chosen his form of torture, and he was sticking to it. The window looked out on a forest of glistening towers, no doubt correctly rendered according to all the laws of optics, but still too slick to be real, like some 1920s expressionist film set. She'd seen the sketches. This was Permutation City, whatever hardware it was running on. She looked down. They were 70 or 80 stories up. The street was all but invisible, but just below the window, a dozen meters to the right, a walkway stretched across to an adjacent building, and she could see the puppet citizens chatting together in twos and threes as they strode towards their imaginary destinations. All of this looked expensive, but slowdown could buy a lot of subjective computing power, if that was the trade-off you wanted to make. How much time had passed in the outside world? Years? Decades? Had she managed to save Francesca? Durham said, "You think I've kidnapped your scan file and run this whole city solely for the pleasure of deceiving you? It's the simplest explanation. It's ludicrous, and you know it. I'm sorry. I know this must be painful for you, but I didn't do it lightly. It's been 7,000 years. I've had a lot of time to think it over." She spun around to face him. "Stop lying to me!" He threw his hands up in a gesture of contrition and impatience. "Maria, you are in the TVC universe. The launch worked. The dust hypothesis has been vindicated. It's a fact, and you'd better come to terms with that, because you're now part of a society which has been living with it for millennia. And I know I said I'd only wake you if Planet Lambert failed, if we needed you to work on the biosphere seed. All right, I've broken my word on that, but it was the wrong promise to make. Planet Lambert hasn't failed. It succeeded beyond your wildest dreams. How could I let you sleep through that?" An interface window appeared in midair beside her, showing a half-lit blue-and-white world. "I don't expect the continents will look familiar. We've given the Autoverse a lot of resources. 7,000 years, for most of us, has been about 3 billion for Planet Lambert." Maria said flatly, "You're wasting your time. Nothing you show me is going to change my mind." But she watched the planet, transfixed, as Durham moved the viewpoint closer. They broke through the clouds near the east coast of a large mountainous island, part of an archipelago straddling the equator. The bare surface rock of the peaks was the color of ochre, no mineral she'd included in the original design, but time and geochemistry could have thrown up something new. The vegetation, which covered almost every other scrap of land right to the waterline, came in shades of blue-green. As the viewpoint descended and the textures resolved themselves, Maria saw only grasses and shrubs, nothing remotely like a terrestrial tree. Durham zeroed in on a meadow not far from the coast, a few hundred meters back according to the scale across the bottom of the image, and about what she would have guessed from cues in the landscape, unexpectedly validated. What looked at first like a cloud of windborne debris, seeds of some kind, blowing above the grass resolved into a swarm of shiny black insects. Durham froze the image, then zoomed in on one of the creatures. It was no insect by the terrestrial definition. There were 4 legs, not 6, and the body was clearly divided into 5 segments. The head, sections bearing the 4 legs, wings, and hind legs, and the tail. Durham made hand movements and rotated the view. The head was blunt, not quite flat, with 2 large eyes, if they were eyes, shiny bluish discs with no apparent structure. The rest of the head was coated in fine hairs lined up in a complex symmetrical pattern which reminded Maria of Maori facial tattoos, sensors for vibration or scent. She said, "Very pretty, but you forgot the mouth." They put food into a cavity directly under the wings. He rotated the body to show her. It adheres to those bristles and gets dissolved by the enzymes they secrete. You'd think it would fall out, but it doesn't. Not until they've finished digesting it and absorbing nutrients, and then a protein on the bristles changes shape, switching off the adhesion. Their whole stomach is nothing but this sticky droplet hanging there, open to the air.
You may have come up with something more plausible.
Durham laughed. Exactly. The single pair of wings were translucent brown, looking like they were made of a thin layer of the same stuff as the exoskeleton. The four legs each had a single joint, and terminated in feathery structures. The tail segment had brown and black markings like a bullseye, but there was nothing at the center. A dark tube emerged from the bottom of the rim, narrowing to a needle-sharp point. The Lambertians have diploid chromosomes, but only one gender. Any two of them can inject DNA, one after the other, into certain kinds of plant cell. Their genes take over the cell and turn it into a cross between a cyst and an egg. They usually choose a particular spot on the stems of certain species of shrub. I don't know if you'd call it parasitism or just nest building on a molecular level. The planet nourishes the embryo and survives the whole process in perfect health, and when the young hatch, they return the favor by scattering seeds. Their ancestors stole some of the control mechanisms from a plant virus 1 billion years ago. There are a lot of genetic exchanges like that. The kingdoms are a lot more biochemically similar here than they were on Earth. Maria turned away from the screen. The stupidest thing was, she kept wanting to ask questions, press him for details. She said, "What's next? You zoom right in and show me the fine anatomical structure? The insect cells, the proteins, the atoms, the autoverse cells? And that's supposed to convince me that the whole planet is embedded in the autoverse? You unfreeze this thing, let it fly around, and I meant to conclude that no real-world computer could ever run an organism so complex, modeled at such a deep level? As if I could personally verify that every flap of its wings corresponded to a valid sequence of a few trillion cellular automaton states? It's no different than the equation results. It wouldn't prove a thing." Durham nodded slowly. "All right. What if I showed you some of the other species? Or the evolutionary history? The paleogenetic record? We have every mutation on file since the year zero. You want to sit down with that and see if it looks authentic?" "No. I want a terminal that works. I want you to let me call my original. I want to talk to her, and between us, maybe we can decide what I'm going to do when I get out of this fucking madhouse and into my own JSN account." Durham looked rattled, and for a moment she believed she might finally be getting through to him. But he said, "I woke you for a reason. We're going to be making contact with the Lambertians soon. It might have been sooner, but there have been complications, political delays." He'd lost her completely now. "Contact with the Lambertians? What's that supposed to mean?" He gestured at the motionless insect, backside and genitals still facing them. "This is not some species I picked at random. This is the pinnacle of autoverse life. They're conscious, self-aware, highly intelligent. They have almost no technology, but their nervous system is about 10 times more complex than a human's, and they can go far beyond that for some tasks, performing a kind of parallel computing in swarms. They have chemistry, physics, astronomy. They know there are 32 atoms, although they haven't figured out the underlying cellular automaton rules yet, and they're modeling the primordial cloud. These are sentient creatures, and they want to know where they came from." Maria turned her hand in front of the screen, bringing the Lambertian's head back into view. She was beginning to suspect that Durham actually believed every word he was saying, in which case, maybe he hadn't personally contrived these aliens. Maybe some other version of him, the flesh and blood original, was deceiving both of them. If that was the case, she was arguing with the wrong person. But what was she supposed to do instead? Start shouting pleas for freedom to the sky? She said numbly,
10 times more complex than a human brain?
Their neurons use conducting polymers to carry the signal instead of membrane action potentials. The cells themselves are comparable in size to a human's, but each axon and dendrite carries multiple signals.
Durham moved the viewpoint behind the Lambertian's eye and showed her.
A neuron in the optic nerve, under close examination, contained thousands of molecules like elaborately knotted ropes, running the whole length of the cell body. At the far end, each polymer was joined to a kind of vesicle, the narrow molecular cable dwarfed by the tiny pouch of cell membrane pinched off from the outside world. There are almost 3,000 distinct neurotransmitters. They're all proteins, built from 3 subunits, with 14 possibilities for each subunit. A bit like human antibodies, the same trick for generating a wide spectrum of shapes. And they bind to their receptors just as selectively as an antibody to an antigen. Every synapse is a 3,000-channel biochemical switchboard with no crosstalk. That's the molecular basis of Lambertian thought. He added wryly, which is more than you and I possess. A molecular basis for anything. We still run the old patchwork models of the human body, expanded and modified according to taste, but still based on the same principles as John Vine's first talking copy. There's a long-term project to give people the choice of being implemented on an atomic level, but quite apart from the political complications, even the enthusiasts keep finding more pressing things to do. Durham moved the viewpoint out through the cell wall and turned it back to face the terminal end of the neuron. He changed the color scheme from atomic to molecular to highlight the individual neurotransmitters with their own distinctive hues. Then he unfroze the image. Several of the gray lipid membrane vesicles twitched open, disgorging floods of brightly colored specks, tumbling past the viewpoint. They resolved into elaborate, irregular globules with a bewildering variety of forms. Durham swung the angle of view forward again and headed for the far side of the synapse. Eventually, Maria could make out color-coded receptors embedded in the receiving neuron cell wall. Long-chain molecules folded together into tight zigzag rings with lumpy depressions on the exposed surface. For several minutes, they watched thousands of mismatched neurotransmitters bounce off one receptor, until Durham became bored and pleaded with the software. Show us a fit. The image blurred for a second, and then returned to the original speed as a correctly shaped molecule finally stumbled onto its target. It hit the receptor and locked into place. Durham plunged the viewpoint through the cell membrane in time to show the immersed tail section of the receptor changing its configuration in response. He said, "That will now catalyze the activation of a second messenger, which will feed energy into the appropriate polymer, unless there's an inhibiting messenger already bound there, blocking access." He spoke to the software again. It took control of the viewpoint and showed them each of the events he described. Maria shook her head, bedazzled.
"Tell me the truth. Who orchestrated this? 3,000 neurotransmitters, 3,000 receptors, 3,000 second messengers. No doubt you can show me the individual structures of all of them, and no doubt they really would behave the way you claim they do. Even writing the software to fake this would have been an enormous job. Who did you commission? There can't be many people who take it on."
Durham said gently, "I commissioned you. You can't have forgotten. A seed for a biosphere? A demonstration that life in the autoverse could be as diverse and elaborate as life on Earth?
No. From A. hydrophila to this would take...
billions of years of autoverse time? Computing power orders of magnitude beyond the resources of 21st century Earth? That's what Planet Lambert needed, and that's exactly what it's been given." Maria backed away from the screen until she could go no further, then slid down against the wall beside the red-draped window and sat on the plushly carpeted floor. She put her face in her hands and tried to breathe slowly. She felt like she'd been buried alive. Did she believe him? It hardly seemed to matter any more. Whatever she did, he was going to keep on bombarding her with evidence like this, consistent with his claims. Whether he was deliberately lying or not, and whether he was being fooled by another version of himself, or whether the dust hypothesis was right after all, he was never going to let her out of here, back into the real world. Psychotic liar, fellow victim, or calm purveyor of the truth, he was incapable of setting her free. Her original was still out there, with the money to save Francesca. That was the point of the whole insane gamble, the payoff for risking her soul. If she could remember that, cling to that, maybe she could keep herself sane. Durham pressed on, oblivious to her distress, or intent on delivering the coup de grace. He said, "Who could have engineered this? You know how long it took Max Lambert to translate a real-world bacterium. Do you honestly believe that I found someone who could manufacture a functioning, novel pseudo-insect out of thin air, let alone an intelligent one? All right, you can't personally check macroscopic behavior against the Autoverse rules, but you can study all the biochemical pathways, trace them back to the ancestral species. You can watch an embryo grow cell by cell, following the gradients of control hormones, the differentiating tissue layers, the formation of the organs. The whole planet is an open book to us. You can examine whatever you like, scrutinize it on any scale, from viruses to ecosystems, from the activation of a molecule of retinal pigment to the geochemical cycles. There are 690 million species currently living on planet Lambert, all obeying the laws of the Autoverse, all demonstrably descended from a single organism which lived 3 billion years ago, and whose characteristics I expect you know by heart. Do you honestly believe that anyone could have designed all that?" Maria looked up at him angrily. "No, of course it evolved. It must have evolved. You can shut up now. You've won. I believe you." "But why did you have to wake me? I'm going to lose my mind." Durham squatted down and put a hand on her shoulder. She started sobbing dryly as she attempted to dissect her loss into parts she could begin to comprehend. Francesca was gone. Aiden was gone. All her friends. All the people she'd ever met. In the flesh, on the networks. All the people she'd ever heard of. Musicians and writers. Philosophers and movie stars. Politicians and serial killers. They weren't even dead. Their lives didn't lie in her past, whole and comprehensible. They were scattered around her like dust, meaningless, disconnected. Everything she'd ever known had been ground down into random noise. Durham hesitated, then put his arms around her clumsily. She wanted to hurt him, but instead she clung to him and wept, teeth clenched, fists tight, shuddering with rage and grief. He said, "You're not going to lose your mind. You can live any life you want to here. 7,000 years means nothing. We haven't lost the old culture. We still have all the libraries, the archives, the databases, and there are thousands of people who want to meet you, people who respect you for what you've done. You're a myth. You're a hero of Elysium. You're the sleeping 18th founder. We'll hold a festival in honor of your awakening." Maria pushed him away. "I don't want that. I don't want any of that." "All right, it's up to you." She closed her eyes and huddled against the wall. She knew she must have looked like a petulant child, but she didn't care. She said fiercely, "You've had the last word. The last laugh. You've brought me to life just to rub my nose in the proof of your precious beliefs. And now I want to go back to sleep, forever. I want all of this to vanish." Durham was silent for a while. Then he said, "You can do that if you really want to. Once I've shown you what you've inherited, once I've shown you how to control it, you'll have the power to seal yourself off from the rest of Elysium. If you choose sleep, then nobody will ever be able to wake you. But don't you want to be there on planet Lambert when we make first contact with the civilization that owes its existence to you? Chapter 24. Rut City. Pier was in his workshop, making a table leg on his lathe, when Kate's latest message caught his eye. "You have to see this. Please, meet me in the city." He looked away. He was working with his favorite timber, sugar pine. He'd constructed his own plantation from a gene library and plant cell maps, modeling individual examples of each cell type down to an atomic level, then encapsulating their essential behavior in rules which he could afford to run billions of times over for tens of thousands of trees. In theory, he could have built the whole plantation from individual atoms, and that would have been the most elegant way to do it by far. But slowing himself down to a time frame in which the trees grew fast enough to meet his needs would have meant leaving Kate far behind. He stopped the lathe and reread the message, which was written on a poster tacked to the workshop's notice board, the only part of his environment he allowed her to access while he was working. The poster looked quite ordinary, except for an eye-catching tendency for the letters to jump up and down when they crossed his peripheral vision. He muttered, "I'm happy here. I don't care what they're doing in the city." The workshop abutted a warehouse full of table legs, 162,329 so far. Pier could imagine nothing more satisfying than reaching the 200,000 mark, although he knew it was likely that he'd change his mind and abandon the workshop before that happened. New vocations were imposed by his exo-self at random intervals, but statistically, the next one was overdue. Immediately before taking up woodwork, he'd passionately devoured all the higher mathematics texts in the central library, ran all the tutorial software, and then personally contributed several important new results to group theory. Untroubled by the fact that none of the Elysian mathematicians would ever be aware of his work. Before that, he'd written over 300 comic operas with librettos in Italian, French, and English, and staged most of them with puppet performers and audience. Before that, he'd patiently studied the structure and biochemistry of the human brain for 67 years. Towards the end, he had fully grasped, to his own satisfaction, the nature of the process of consciousness. Every one of these pursuits had been utterly engrossing and satisfying at the time. He'd even been interested in the Elysians once. No longer. He preferred to think about table legs. He was still interested in Kate, though. He'd chosen that as one of his few invariants, and he'd been neglecting her lately. They hadn't met in almost a decade. He looked around the workshop wistfully, his gaze falling on the pile of fresh timber in the corner, but then he strengthened his resolve. The pleasures of the lathe beckoned, but love meant making sacrifices. Pier took off his dust coat, stretched out his arms, and fell backwards into the sky above the city. Kate met him while he was still airborne, swooping down from nowhere and grabbing his hand, nearly wrenching his arm from its socket. She yelled above the wind,
"So, you're still alive after all. I was beginning to think you'd shut yourself down, gone looking for the next life without me."
Her tone was sarcastic, but there was an edge of genuine relief. 10 years could still be a long time, if you let it. Pier said gently but audibly, "You know how busy I am, and when I'm working..." She laughed derisively.
"Working? Is that what you call it? Taking pleasure from something that would bore the stupidest factory robot to death?"
Her hair was long and jet black, whipping up around her face as if caught by the wind at random, but always concealing just enough to mask her expression.
"You're still..."
The wind drowned out his words. Cade had disabled his aphysical intelligibility. He shouted, "You're still a sculptor, aren't you? You ought to understand. The wood, the grain, the texture."
"I understand that you need prosthetic interest to help pass the time, but you could try setting the parameters more carefully."
"Why should I?" Being forced to raise his voice made him feel argumentative. He willed his exo-self to circumvent the effect, and screamed calmly, "Every few decades at random, I take on new goals at random. It's perfect. How could I improve on a scheme like that? I'm not stuck on any one thing forever. However much you think I'm wasting my time, it's only for 50 or 100 years. What difference does that make in the long run?"
"You could still be more selective."
"What did you have in mind? Something socially useful? Famine relief work? Counseling the dying? Or something intellectually challenging? Uncovering the fundamental laws of the universe?" "I have to admit that the TVC rules have slipped my mind completely. It might take me all of 5 seconds to look them up again. Searching for God? That's a difficult one. Paul Durham never returns my calls. Self-discovery?"
"You don't have to leave yourself open to every conceivable absurdity."
"If I limited the range of options, I'd be repeating myself in no time at all. And if you find the phase I'm passing through so unbearable, you can always make it vanish. You can freeze yourself until I change." Kate was indignant.
"I have other time frames to worry about besides yours."
"The Elysians aren't going anywhere." He didn't add that he knew she'd frozen herself 6 times already, each time for a few more years than the time before. She turned towards him, parting her hair to show one baleful eye.
"You're fooling yourself, you know. You're going to repeat yourself eventually. However desperately you reprogram yourself, in the end you're going to come full circle and find that you've done it all before."
Pierre laughed indulgently and shouted, "We've certainly been through all this before, and you know that's not true. It's always possible to synthesize something new, a novel art form, a new field of study, a new aesthetic, a new obsession." Falling through the cool late afternoon air beside her was exhilarating, but he was already missing the smell of wood dust. Kate rendered the air around them motionless and silent, although they continued to descend. She released his hand and said,
"I know we've been through this before. I remember what you said last time. If the worst came to the worst, for the 1st 100 years, you can contemplate the number 1. For the 2nd 100 years, you can contemplate the number 2, and so on, ad infinitum. Whenever the numbers grow too big to hold in your mind, you can always expand your mind to fit them. QED. You'll never run out of new and exciting interests."
Pierce said gently, "Where's your sense of humor? It's a simple proof that the worst-case scenario is still infinite. I never suggested actually doing that."
"But you might as well."
Now that her face was no longer concealed, she looked more forlorn than angry, by choice, if not necessarily by artifice.
"Why do you have to find everything so fulfilling? Why can't you discriminate? Why can't you let yourself grow bored with things? Then move on. Pick them up again later if you feel the urge."
"Sounds awfully quaint to me. Very human."
"It did work for them, sometimes."
"Yes, and I'm sure it works for you, sometimes. You drift back and forth between your art and watching the great Elysian soap opera, with a decade or two of aimless depression in between. You're dissatisfied most of the time, and letting that happen is a conscious choice, as deliberate and arbitrary as anything I impose on myself. If that's how you want to live, I'm not going to try to change you, but you can't expect me to live the same way." She didn't reply. After a moment, the bubble of still air around them blew away, and the roar of the wind drowned the silence again. Sometimes he wondered if Kate had ever really come to terms with the shock of discovering that stowing away had granted them not a few 100 years in a billionaire's sanctuary, but a descent into the abyss of immortality.
the copy who had persuaded David Hawthorne to turn his back on the physical world, the committed follower, even before her death, of the solipsist nation philosophy, the woman who had needed no brain rewiring or elaborate external contrivances to accept her software incarnation, now acted more and more like a flesh-and-blood wannabe, or rather, Elysian wannabe, year by year, and there was no need for it. Their tiny slice of infinity was as infinite as the whole. Ultimately, there was nothing the Elysians could do that Kate couldn't, except walk among them as an equal, and that was what she seemed to covet the most. True, the Elysians had deliberately set out to achieve the logical endpoint of everything she'd ever believed Copy should be striving for, while she'd merely hitched a ride by mistake. Their world would always, Elysian instant compared to Elysian instant, be bigger and faster than her own. So naturally, according to archaic human values, which she hadn't had the sense to erase, she wanted to be part of the main game. But Pierre still found it absurd that she spent her life envying them when she could have generated or even launched her own equally complex, equally populous society and turned her back on the Elysians as thoroughly as they'd turned their back on Earth. It was her choice. Pierre took it in his stride, along with all their other disagreements. If they were going to spend eternity together, he believed they'd resolve their problems eventually, if they could be resolved at all. It was early days yet, as it always would be. He rolled over and looked down at the city, or the strange recursive map of the city which they made do with, buried as they were in the walls and foundations of the real thing. Malcolm Carter's secret parasitic software wasn't blind to its host. They could spy on what was going on in the higher levels of the program, which surreptitiously ran them, even though they couldn't affect anything which happened there. They could snatch brief, partial recordings of activity in the real city and play them back in a limited duplicate environment. It was a bit like being the widely separated letters in the text of Ulysses, which read, Pierre and Kate read, Leopold Bloom wandered through Dublin, if not quite so crude an abridgment. Certainly the view from the air was still breathtaking. Pierre had to concede that it was probably indistinguishable from the real thing. The sun was setting over the ocean as they descended, and the Ulam Falls glistened in the east like a sheet of amber set in the granite face of Mount Vine. In the foothills, a dozen silver needles and obsidian prisms, fanciful watchtowers, caught the light and scattered it between them. Pierre followed the river down, through lush tropical forests, across dark plains of grassland, into the city itself. The buildings on the outskirts were low and sprawling, becoming gradually taller and narrower. The profile swept up in a curve which echoed the shape of Mount Vine. Closer to the center, a thousand crystalline walkways linked the city's towers at every level, connections so dense and stellated as to make it seem possible that every building was joined directly to all the rest. That wasn't true, but the sense that it might have been was still compelling. Decorative crowds filled the streets and walkways, mindless puppets obeying the simplest rules, but looking as purposeful and busy as any human throng. A strange adornment, perhaps, but not much stranger than having buildings and streets at all. Most Elysians merely visited this place, but last time Pierre had concerned himself with such things, a few hundred of them, mainly third generation, had taken up inhabiting the city full-time, adopting every detail of its architecture and geography as fixed parameters, swearing fidelity to its Euclidean distances. Others, mainly first generation, had been appalled by the behavior of this sect. It was strange how reversion was the greatest taboo amongst the oldest Elysians, who were so conservative in most other ways. Maybe they were afraid of becoming homesick. Kate said,
Town Hall.
He followed her down through the darkening air. The city always smelt sweet to Pierre. Sweet but artificial, like a newly unwrapped electronic toy.